Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. This is the last talk of the Range Retreat 2539. Again, the perception which is uppermost in my mind is just how quickly 22 Range Retreats have gone. Not one retreat, but 22. And it just brings to mind the sense of urgency which is necessary if one is to gain the fruits of this practice which the Buddha bequeathed to the world. It's not a practice for those who are lax. It's a practice which will give fruits to those who exert their effort, who strive, who give this path everything they've got. Those who are Aryas in the world, the stream enterers, the once returners, non-returners and arahats, there are these beings in the world, but they're rare. And one of the reasons they are rare is because few people strive, few people have the opportunity to strive. So whenever we do get the opportunity to practice, even if it's only how many days to the end of the range now? Four or five days. In some reading I was doing on another subject, we came across a passage in the Dhammapada which was saying that if a person of a bhikkhu strives just for one day and one night, then one can attain something which a person living in idleness for 100 years can never reach. Which was reinforcing a common theme which runs throughout the teachings of the Buddha, that one needs to put forth effort and strive. But not just effort, not just blind effort, but wise effort. Be able to know the time to, as it were, put the tongue against the palate and strive hard to overcome the defilements of the mind, to quieten the mind, to keep the sense restraint, to develop the meditation states, and to penetrate the truth of things. The truth of things has been hidden for lifetimes. It's not easy to penetrate. You do need effort, you do need striving. And it's always those monks you've seen who have put forth the effort, who have avoided the easy way of conversations, of going where they want, who avoided distractions, and whenever they have a chance have stayed in their huts and sat cross-legged and watched their breath. It's those monks who are the ones who achieve things on this path. So I would like to, at the end of this Range Retreat, to encourage a sense of urgency. But have you reached a goal yet, a place of security and safety? Because if not, one still needs to strive. In fact, even if one has reached the security of a stream enterer, one still needs to strive. To strive for the complete ending of dukkha. Sometimes that one can waste a lot of time talking and not practicing. And one of the teachings, I mentioned this before during this Range Retreat, which for me anyway sort of cut away a lot of argument and a lot of doubt and a lot of discussion with others, was that famous teaching of the Buddha to Upali, that whatever Upali leads to is turning away from the world, nibbida, which leads to dispassion, viraga, which leads to cessation, to peace, upasama, to this insight of abhinya, which leads to sambodhi, the Buddha knowledge, which leads to nibbana. So anything which is leading to these things, this is the Dhamma, this is the vinaya of the Buddha. Now you should analyze that saying of the Buddha to Venerable Upali. The Dhamma is what leads to these states. And if it's any teaching, any practice, any conduct which does lead to attachment in the world, which leads to making the world look attractive, which leads to clinging on to something, even the most refined things, if it does not lead to the peacefulness of the mind, and I spent a lot of time in this range retreat indicating that the peace of the mind is called jhanas. That's what we mean by a peaceful mind. Because every successive jhana is characterized by the happiness of more and more profound states of peacefulness, of stillness of mind. Once the Buddha described the jhanas in terms of the three sankharas, in terms of kaya sankhara, vachi sankhara, and jitta sankhara. He described it as this in many places, in this context. And he mentioned just how that the practice of jhana is quietening and quelling these three conditioned factors of body, speech and mind, of quelling these, tranquilizing these, stopping these, bringing these to cessation one by one. And first of all, he said, it's the vachi sankhara is quelled. And the way you quell the vachi sankhara, this is the speech. First of all, the external speech is quelled by sitting quietly. But it's the internal speech which is the hardest to quell. That which we call thought, thinking, the inner speech, the inner conversation. And the Buddha said that this is the first of the sankharas which is quelled, which disappears, which goes to cessation, even only a temporary cessation, in the second of the jhanas. But there's no vitakka vichara, there's no internal speech. It's finished with, gone. The mind is quiet. The mind cannot think. The mind is fixed on one object, not able to move. The movement of the mind onto its object is the most refined form of inner speech. And you may even call it subverbal speech. The mind about to do something. And the second of the sankharas, which comes to upasama, to quietness, to cessation, is the kaya sankhara, the bodily sankhara. And this, the Buddha said, occurs in fourth jhana. The body and all the remnants of the body disappear in the fourth jhana with the disappearance of the breath. And I mentioned this in previous talks, that even though the objects of the jhanas are not perceived as the breath, but are objects of mental consciousness, but they're related to the breath in the sense that it's how the mind perceives the breath. Not how the body perceives the breath, how the mind perceives the breath. This is the fuel, the bricks which make up the perception. However, the thing about the breath which the mind notices is its blissfulness, because first of all the five senses have been extinguished. Second jhana, because the inner speech has been extinguished, and one has samadhi. And then the third, because piti has been extinguished, is the sukha. And the fourth, because all of those piti sukhas have been extinguished, one has the equanimity. So this stage where the kaya sankhara has gone to peacefulness, and then through practicing the arupa jhanas and ending up in the cessation of all that's felt and perceived, sanya vediyati nirodha, cessation of all perception and all feeling, all vedana, and that's the point the Buddha say where the citta sankhara has ended. And this is like the upasama. This is the quietening of the sankharas. The synonym for nibbana is sabbe sankhara samatha. The samatharing, which is also a synonym for upasama, the quelling, the quietening of all the sankharas, all the conditioned things, all that was came into being, ceasing. So it's the Dharma, the Vinaya, is leading, is that which leads to quietness, to peace, to cessation. That's why we have the word upasana, which leads to abhinya, to this profound knowledge. The word for to know is janati or nya. The root is abhijnana. The abhijanati, as the same in the abhidharma, the profound dhamma. The abhinya is a profound insight, a profound knowledge. And this is what the practice should be leading to. And leading to sambodhi, enlightenment knowledge, and nibbana itself, the flame going out, the khandhas ceasing. So this is the acid test to find out the Dhamma and the Vinaya, and the test by it, seeing if it works, see if it does lead to things like jhana, to great insight wisdom. And in my 22 years experience as a monk, it's one can discuss a lot about what insight is and what wisdom is, and different monks will have different ideas, and those monks will quote suttas. And sometimes insight, the true meaning of what the Buddha was teaching, is hard to come to a conclusion on. But one can always judge the Dhamma by whether it leads to these things, whether it leads to peace, to stillness, whether it encourages the person into renunciation, nekamma. Now, if the Dhamma which a person has realized makes them disrobe, makes them go off into the world and associate overmuch with lay people, which gets them involved in things against their tendencies. So if it gets them involved in things and their tendency is for that, then that cannot be the Dhamma, that cannot be the Vinaya, that cannot be the teachings of the Buddha. These things lead to seclusion. These things lead to giving up. They lead to giving up of your physical possessions and your material possessions. We mentioned before the great teaching we used to get in Thailand of going up to see Ajahn Chah's hut, see the room where he slept, and the impression you always got when you went up there, where are those things? There's hardly anything in there. That's why it was Ajahn Chah, the great teacher. Not only had his Dhamma, his Vinaya, his practice meant that he'd given up the things of the mind, he'd also given up the things of the world, his possessions. So if it truly is a Dhamma and Vinaya of the Buddha, these are the signs by which you can know it. See if it leads to peace, to renunciation, to giving up, to a peaceful lifestyle, leads to being able to sit in meditation for long periods in profound stillness, which leads, you know, to an impeccable virtuous lifestyle, not getting angry at others or upset at others, and someone who's frugal and encourages other people to be frugal, to be someone who has few possessions. This is a sign that this is a Dhamma and a Vinaya of the Buddha. So remember this. This is much more important than deciding it through debate or argument. And for this very reason, that during this rains retreat, I've encouraged a lot of practice of calming the mind down, of moving towards the jhanas. And I've done this for a specific reason, not just because that the jhanas are the goal, but because if one puts the direction towards the peace of the mind, if that is one's goal, one's aspiration, then along the path to those peaceful states, the obstacles one meets, one can realize as obstructions. If one never attempts the jhanas, one doesn't know those obstructions. One can live what one thinks is a very peaceful and happy lifestyle as a monk, if one doesn't exert oneself, and think maybe that most of the obstacles, most of the defilements are not really there. Ajahn Chah's simile was that it's only when you put a tiger in a cage does it show its fierce nature of roaring. If it's freed, then it's content, but it's dangerous. When one attempts to calm the mind down, that's when some of the finer defilements start to manifest. If you never attempt to calm the mind, you never see those defilements. They're just quite content ruling your mind. Only when you challenge them do you see their struggle. And so even if one does not attain to a jhana, the very act of trying, of moving in that direction, inspiring to those peaceful states of mind, will make it quite clear to you that there are some very refined obstacles. These are defilements. These are manifestation of the kilesas. This is craving. This is upadana. And this is what you're experiencing, not what you're thinking. This is not a theory or something you read in the texts. This is something you meet in your mind as you practice. Why is it that I cannot watch the breath? Because of tanha, because of upadana, because of craving, because of this taking up we call attachment, because of avijja. It's right here that the wisdom starts to arise when you test the mind. If you don't test students, they can look as if they're doing well. When you've got a lax teacher, the students aren't tried. They don't get very far. They don't learn very much. With a tough teacher who's giving them examinations every week, every day, those students learn very quickly, or they drop out. So the testing oneself with the ability to calm the mind is an important way of understanding what these defilements truly are, the obstacles to the peaceful state of mind. More than that, that if one ever can just get into a jhana just once, to know that it's possible and to understand there is such a thing as a peaceful state of mind where the five senses are just not there. To experience that and know that through experience as a first jhana. To go deeper and just to see all thinking, all movement of mind just eradicated, just not there. And the mind just in samadhi, the sustained attention on one thing, not two things, not one and a half things, one thing and one thing only for long periods of time, without the mind being able to move even a millimeter away from that object. Completely stuck, completely absorbed, completely with one thing, the bliss of second jhana. Time after time after time, minutes, hours gone by, and just observing, percipient of bliss with no change. To see that such a state of mind can exist, to experience it, gives you a deeper insight into what peace truly means, what samadhi truly means, where this meditation is leading. You notice afterwards that something has ceased to give rise to this peaceful state. The mind recognizes these states as peace, deeper and more profound peacefulness. Sometimes one thinks if it's the first jhana, this is the most peaceful thing there ever is. Sometimes you think it's the most peaceful thing there ever could be. This is bliss, this is the highest, this is nibbana here and now. The Buddha recorded as some ascetics saying. And that accorded with their experience because they did not know further or deeper than that. Beware of speculation. Speculation only goes as far as your experience. And there's more than what you've experienced. The things which you just don't know. So experience these things and know these things first hand, and you get some understanding of what we mean by this nirodha, the cessation. Things have actually disappeared. Fundamental things. Not superficial ideas, but fundamental parts of what you thought was always your mind, always your body. The senses completely cut away, disappeared. Have you ever had a moment when you have consciousness but the senses aren't there? It's not that you just don't hear anything, you can't hear anything. It's not you don't see anything, there's no possibility of seeing or tasting or smelling or touching. Just those five senses are far away from you. They're just completely gone, they're ceased. You have an idea of what we mean by cessation. These things are not available to the jitta in these states. And you see something has ceased, a sankhara which once came into being is no longer there. Yankinchi samudaya dhammang sabantang nirodha dhammanti, as we chanted a few moments ago in the Dhammacakka Sutta. The wisdom, the insight, the realization of the stream enter. All that was of a nature to arise, all that has ceased. Not as a thought, not as an idea, but you know, you've experienced the cessation of something. That's profound. Once you realize that these things which you thought to be such an essential part of existence. Sorry, not what you thought to be an essential part of existence, what you assumed. Beneath thought, before thought, what you essentially assumed to be basic and fundamental, you find is no longer there. That's why these states sometimes shock one. It's one of the barriers, one of the obstacles one comes up with before one enters into a jhana. I've mentioned this before. One cannot give these things up. There's actually an attachment to the five senses. Sometimes that one has no business listening or feeling the body. But the mind just goes off and looks for something to distract it. You actually go out listening for sounds, which is the meaning of Ajahn Chah's statement that it's not that sounds disturb you, you disturb sounds. The mind actually, you can see this happening sometimes when there's the last vestige of udacha, restlessness, one of the five hindrances still present in the mind. You're reasonably quiet, but the Udicca sends the mind out listening. What's out there? It sends it out to the body, feeling. Are the knees okay? How's the back? And this is, why does this happen? If you can notice this and pass beyond it, you see it is just the concern before thought as an anusaya, as an underlying tendency, the concern for the five senses. Why are you concerned with the five senses? Because it's a concern with your physical body. Sometimes we assume we're not attached to our body. We all know we're going to die. Many of us have been to autopsies and seen the body cut up bit by bit and seen it opened up and all the little parts. We've been there, but that's not attachment to body. That's the coarser form of attachment to body. The finer form of attachment to body is the attachment which manifests with the five senses, whose job, whose purpose, whose function is to preserve this body and to bring it happiness, to ward off pain. That's what the five senses do. It's its main job, to look after this physical body. And that's why the inability to renounce, let go of, give up the five senses and enter into a jhana is because there's a subtle remnant of attachment to your physical body. You're concerned about it. You're worried about it. You can't just let it, as the Buddha said, if necessary, let all the blood dry up. There would just be dried flesh and sinews covering bones. That expression of the Buddha was not an expression of like someone being gung-ho and sort of enlightenment or bust. It was an expression of complete renunciation or relinquishment of the physical body, and as such relinquishment of the five senses, which is a manifestation in the sensory world. That's the obstacle, that's the craving, that's the upadana. If one doesn't attempt to get past that point, one will never know this is an obstacle. One will think this is normal, usual, natural, as some people say. You get beyond that, pass beyond that, then afterwards you know why it was so difficult before. There was attachment to the body. I think that's one reason why the Kuba Ajahn, the teachers in Thailand, used to make such a big business out of doing kaya gata sati, the mindfulness on the body. They always said you've got to do a lot of mindfulness on the body, mindfulness of the body, mindfulness on the body, again and again and again, before you can do anything else, before you even do mindfulness of Vedana, feeling, or mindfulness of the jitta, or mindfulness of dhammas. Kaya gata sati, keep on doing that. Do 32 parts, do loathsomeness of the body. Why? And I thought as a Westerner, I thought, well, I know the body's not me, I know I've got to give it up when I die. That's simple stuff, that's kindergarten stuff. It's not. This is refined stuff. There is an anusaya, an underlying tendency of attachment to this body, concern with this body. If there's not that anusaya, then you can go into jhanas with ease. At least first jhana anyway. You can let go of the five senses. They disappear. And you know this is a Dhamma of the Buddha, a Vinaya of the Buddha, a training of the Buddha. But it's leading to letting go, to renunciation, to the upasama of the five senses. The five external senses go to peace, to tranquility. They're no longer there temporarily. It's like turning down the sound of a radio or a television. Turn it down so much, there's no sound coming out from the speakers. It's all gone, finished. ceased for the time being. This is what we mean by cessation, by letting go, by relinquishment, giving up. It's done stage by stage. You give up your food, eat whatever comes in the one meal a day. You give up your physical possessions, you give up your beauty sleep, you give up so many things. If you're going to give up so much, just go for broke, give the whole lot up. Don't finish halfway giving up some things and keeping others. If you want to attach to something and keep things, then just disrobe and go in the world and enjoy yourself like all the other people in the world. If you want to give up the lot. Don't be in between. A full renunciation of the body. Once you can renounce the body, that's only the first step. You've got to start renouncing the mind. That's even more difficult. There's an attachment here. You're also seeing the manifestation of the illusion of self, because it's the self which is attaching to this body, or rather the illusion of self. And the illusion of a self, how that actually manifests in one's experience, is the controller. The controller of the body and its messengers, which check whether the body is okay, is the five senses. And the sense of self identifies with the body so much because in its life it's never experienced anything apart from the body. All your thoughts and imaginations are still connected with the body. To fully leave the body, renounce the body, you have to go into a jhana where the body has disappeared. There's no perception of body. The five senses have gone. The mind is the sense which is operating here. And once one can get into these stages, one realizes what it means to let go of the body. And that's a relief. It's a bliss. And one finds that, again, the obstacle, which is one of the last to be given up, there's many which are the last to be given up. I'm talking about the refined obstacles now. You can see it is the sense that this is my body. I'm concerned about it. I'm worried about it. It's fear. Fear of letting go. Whenever there's a fear, it means it's pointing to an attachment, something which one is not willing to let go of. That's the place where fear arises. And so that fear, before one enters into a jhana, it's showing you, it's pointing to an attachment there somewhere, something which you're not willing to give up. Be careful not to think at this point, because you can start justifying. These things don't need to be given up. You can get enlightened without giving up these things. Be careful of that justification. That's Mara. Because it does not lead to giving up. It does not lead to dispassion. It does not lead to peace. It does not lead to abhinya. It does not lead to nibbana, cessation. It leads in the opposite, keeping things. Keeping the five senses, keeping sensory experience, just keeping a little bit of body, just to make sure everything is all right. You have to let go of the whole lot. That takes courage at first to face that fear, but even more powerful than courage is to have the insight which shows that this is the illusion of self trying to protect what it thinks is one of its possessions, the body. And the senses, the five senses. It is that inside of you, that sort of feeling which you take to be a self, which is hanging on and clinging on at all costs. It's awija, just right there. And if you can just get past that point and get to your first full letting go, then get into a jhana, then you can get some insight. You've seen a profound kilesa. They call these things upakilesas, these refined defilements of the mind. So one of the reasons why I've taught in this way, and teach them this way every rains retreat, is not just so you can attain sort of these jhana states for their own sake, so you can bliss out. It's also so you can see what has been blocking you from these blameless happinesses, which the Buddha said should not be feared, but which should be encouraged. So you can see what the blockages are. You can see the sense of self, the illusion of self there. You see the craving and the upadana sort of resulting from that illusion or delusion, blocking you and stopping you getting peaceful. That's where one learns the Dhamma. That's where one sees it for oneself. You can go back afterwards into the suttas and use the suttas to prop up and amplify. Because if you talk about your own experiences, sometimes people don't believe you. They sort of want to sort of justify it with the suttas. And if it is a true experience, you usually can justify it very easily. Not just in one passage, again and again and again and again. Not just in obscure passages, but in the very heart, the basic teachings which the Buddha repeated again and again and again. It's a sign that you're on the right path. But the main sign is that this leads to the silence, the profound silences inside. I've also, teaching like this, done this for another reason as well, is that to put seeds in the mind. Because once one realizes just see how this mind is conditioned, how it responds to what it hears, what it sees, what it thinks about, you start to realize that it's an important contribution to the attainment of the enlightenment wisdoms. To hear teachings such as this, even though you may not agree with these teachings, I don't care. Because despite you, there's seeds which will go in the mind, which at the right time and the right place will bear their fruit, despite what you think. Many of the things which I heard as a young monk, you didn't believe, you didn't sort of take seriously. It's only later on, when your mind is ripe, at certain stages, you recall these things. And that's when they work, that's when they do their job. As it says in the Mahavedala Sutta, there's five parikara, five supports for right view. I take this, the right view, which is the right view of the stream enterer, which is that right view which arises at the point where one gains the fruit of stream entry, the first enlightenment wisdom which arises in the practice. There are five supports. And those five supports are sila, or virtue, sutta, or what you've heard from Aryans, the right Dhamma, sakkaccha, the discussion about these things, and samatha and vipassana, the tranquility training and insight training. These are the five supports for gaining the view of the Dhamma, for gaining the insight, the jnana, the abhinya of the first stage of enlightenment. You have to have sila, virtuous conduct. Not just sila with keeping precepts, but the other silas as well. Things like Indriya Samvara sila, which is also part of this thing we call sila, which is sense restraint. This is all part of this thing which we call sila. Keeping the precepts, right livelihood, the not going to unsuitable places, not listening to radios, televisions, watching movies on the plane. These things, one has to give these things up. Because they're not sense restraint. one has to do this thing. If one does this, one has this sila, it's a force, it's a power. If one also has a sutta, this is not S-U-T-T-A, the teachings of the Buddha, the threads of the Dhamma. This is like having heard. They used to call people like Ananda, Bahu Sutang, one who has heard much. In particular, it meant one who knows much, because the teachings, the theoretical teachings of the Dhamma were taught by word of mouth. This time we can say who studied much, or heard much, or learnt much of the true teachings of the Dhamma. This is actually important, it's vital to the attainment of these things. If one has heard wrong teachings, they really put a big obstacle in the path to enlightenment. Sakaccha, the discussion, make sure with our ears, make sure these teachings are the right ones. And it sort of actually irons out any sort of wrong ideas. And then vipassana and samatha. But these five things, these are five seeds, which when planted in the mind, eventually bear fruit. When they bear fruit, it's very hard to discern. Sometimes someone like Venerable Sariputta, just fanning the Buddha when he became enlightened, or just a couple of words from the monk Asaji when he got his stream entry. But it's all those things which happened before, the seeds which finally bore fruit at that moment, at that time. As one practices this path of the Buddha, one practices and practices, sometimes the mind doesn't get quiet, and one has to bear with that. But there are times when the mind is quiet. I gave a simile today. It's like a sick person who's chronically sick. They have their good days and their bad days. When they're bad days, they're just so sick they can't even remember to take their medicine. All they can think about is the pain and discomfort of their illness. It's in the good days, when they're still sick but not so sick, that they have the opportunity to take the matter in hand, to seek out a doctor, to think about the medicine, to think of ways or work out ways to end their sickness on the good days. If they've been taught or encouraged or heard about such doctors or medicines, then on those days they'll remember and think them over. In the same way that sickness, which is our chronic sickness, is a sickness of avijja, of delusion, which manifests with the pain of craving and attachment, and the dukkha which follows. Craving itself is dukkha. It's that thirst, that unpeacefulness of the mind, the agitation of the mind, the burden of having to seek for something. The craving itself is dukkha, whether one gets what one wants or not. It is this sickness which we have. That sickness sometimes is very bad. There's very little we can do with it. We have our good days, we have our bad days, but when it's a good day, when the craving, when the upadana, the attachment is weak, when the delusion is, as it were, nodding or dozing, it's on those good days that we have the opportunity to do something. When the nivaranas, the hindrances, are weak for one reason or another, that's the time we have the opportunity, the chance to gain one of these enlightenment wisdoms. If we have the seed there already put in our minds, the teachings we have heard and read from those monks we really respect, even if it's a monk you don't respect, at that time those teachings will come up because they resonate with what you're experiencing. That's why you remember them. And that's when you penetrate them. And that's when you see the Dhamma. This is how the attainment of stream entry happens. And I've mentioned this before, that it blasts and shatters much of what you thought was obvious and true. You see anew. You see the Dhamma. This is what happens. From then on, at least you're secure in knowing exactly what you have to do. You know the Dhamma. What anyone else says, it's like water off the duck's back. When one sees that Dhamma, one knows what to do. What does one have to do? One has to practice that Dhamma. One gains even more diligence, more energy, more inclination to this. Remember, this is not up to you. This is not your choice. You have no part in this. That which you call you is just the illusion of self. This is a natural process which happens according to its own rules and laws. You can neither stop it nor hurry it at this stage. It's not you doing this, although it can appear as such for the Putucana. Whether you like it or not, this is going to happen. As it does happen, as the mind does incline more and more to these states which Venerable Pali pointed out, nibbida, just revulsion from the world. As the Buddha once said, it's like seeing the body just as one would see a sore or a boil oozing through, was it 9 orifices, pus, smelling, stinking. That one views the body in that way. One hasn't got a choice. That's just the natural result. Why does that happen? Because that's necessary to be able to let go of the body. If one does not see the body as dukkha, as roga, as sickness, as a dart, as a calamity, as an affliction, sambhada. The Buddha gave these similes one after the other. I can't recall them all, but he gave many similes to make it just quite plain you can't regard this body in any other way. Once that happens, nibbida, it gives rise to viraga. Once you see this body like bunch of dung, of course you just want to wash your hands of it. Just like if you get a little bit of feces on your hand after going to the toilet, you have to wash it. You can't say, oh, I'm going to wash my hands later. You've got to wash your hands straight away. Even a little bit stinks. In the same way that nibbida leads to viraga, the mind just lets go of the body. It has to. That's its nature. That's the way the path actually occurs. When it lets go, that's why we get nirodha, cessation, giving up the khandhas. It's why that the mind goes to upasama. We talk about letting go, letting go, letting go. People say it's so hard to do because you've got to get nibbida first of all before you get viraga. You've got to see that this is a problem. If you're equanimous, well, why let go of the body? It's the same as keeping it. You never let go that way. You've got to have nibbida first of all. That leads to viraga, which leads to upasama. You've letting go of a whole bunch of dukkha. And once you can do that, you're on the path. Once you've let go of one bit of dukkha, this is fun, this is peace, this is profound. This is experience of a religious truth, which, you know, the heart recognizes this. This is not an illusion. This is not sort of imagination. This is not some speculation or some sort of fantasy. This is the most real thing you can experience. The most profound thing. Once you get in the habit of this, then you just go, go, go. You realize the more you let go of, just the more peace there is. The more you let go of, not just external things, not just the body, you let go all of the mind, every last vestige of the mind, of feeling, perception, all thoughts, all knowing. You let go of vijnana as well. Let go of knowing, let go of willing, let go of conceiving, ideas and views. You've got to let go of the whole lot. You have to let go of all the papancha, all the proliferations which we call the five khandhas, until there's nothing there. That's all gone. Cease. Why do you want to hold on to these things? Why won't you let them go? Ask questions like that at the right time and you'll get insight into the illusion of self. That's why you can't let these things go. Attachment has got two ends. What you attach to and what's doing the attaching. For most people, when they contemplate attachment, they only look at what they're attaching to. They never look at what's doing the attaching. That's why that, okay, they might let go of what they're attaching to, but the claw goes out to grab onto something else, and then something else, and then something else. If you want to overcome attachment, upadana, don't look at what you're attaching to. Look at what's doing the attaching. Cut that off. Destroy that. Annihilate that. And then all attachment disappears. There's freedom, relinquishment, peace, cessation, nibbana. And you know nibbana. You don't need to look in a dictionary to find its etymology. You know it as an experience. The blissful, peaceful, the end of all these things. One has been wandering around in samsara, lifetime after lifetime, because of some sort of attachment which one thought was harmless, which one justified and thought was true. That's why one was born. Be careful, that's why one will be born again and again and again and again. One has the chance, don't waste it. The range retreat is almost finished, so what? One can only finish when one gains one of these great insights. Then one can say, the retreat is finished. And one can relax and put one's feet up and go and read a Newsweek or Time magazine. But not before. So this is my parting talk to you this evening before I go off to Indonesia tomorrow afternoon. So even though there are a few things which need to be done, do not forget the main purpose of your being a monk. And may you all reach the goal of full and perfect enlightenment as soon as possible, before it's too late. That's enough for this evening. Has anyone got any comments or questions? Okay.